Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across the country and the world, karaoke is more than a fad, it's a phenomenon. Here's karaoke fanatic Jessica Murillo explaining the appeal after performing at Razzie's Bar in Somerville, Massachusetts.
I love karaoke. I am a junkie. Karaoke gives you the chance to, like, really let that, like, I want to be on stage in the center all the time. I think it lets you get that out.
This hour, On Point, karaoke and the superstar inside you. You can join the conversation. Are you a karaoke lover, or do you think that the singing should be left to the professionals? Have you stepped up to the stage and sung your heart out? Have you been brave enough to do that? And joining me now from New York is Brian Raftery. He's written for Wired, Spin, GQ, and Entertainment Weekly. And his new book is Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Brian Raftery, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me.
So let's get one thing out of the way. What's the right way to pronounce the word karaoke?
Well, it's actually karaoke, which is a Japanese term that combines the words empty and orchestra. But I always find that if I try to pronounce it that way in front of Westerners, they think I'm being some sort of a karaoke elitist. So, and it sort of prompts a lot of confused looks. So as long as your Japanese-speaking fans will forgive me, I'm going to stick with karaoke just
okay.
for today.
Okay, and I can say karaoke too then, I guess.
Sure, yes.
Okay, that works. How popular is karaoke? I mean, when many of us think about it, we think that it's this kind of fringe thing, or, you know, something you do on a drunken Saturday night, maybe. But it's actually much more popular than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's moved beyond, I think, culturally in America, this sort of easy punchline that we think of, just people sort of get up once in a while they're very drunk, and, you know, maybe once in a lifetime, once a year, and it becomes some bad office party anecdote. That part of karaoke still exists, but there are so many places to do it now, and it's everywhere in the culture. I mean, there's now competing video games with karaoke. You know, whereas it used to be you could only do it if you were over 21 and going out to a bar, the karaoke industry very wisely decided to start making at-home machines about 10 years ago. So now it's become this sort of, you know, any place, anywhere, any demographic, which is interesting because, you know, when it started out in America, no one really wanted to do it for years and years.
Which is sort of interesting because the United States Americans are certainly more extroverted than the Japanese, for example, where karaoke has been very, very popular.
Yeah, I mean, it started there. And one of the things that I found very confusing about karaoke's history is that as Americans, we were kind of the last on board. I mean, it started in Japan in the early 70s and spread throughout Asia in the late 70s and then through parts of Europe. But Americans were always sort of very hesitant. The early karaoke businessmen and who were trying to start this industry and get people singing every night would have huge problems getting people to come up on stage. They would sort of go out every weekend and kind of hustle the crowd to get people to go up. And it strikes me as strange only because Americans are so exhibitionist and we do sort of have this, you know, love of the spotlight. And the only reason I can think of that is that, you know, possibly because American culture is so, you know, we're so trenched with popular culture that we really sort of have this very big hang-up about who's a professional and who's a star and who's not. And we've always sort of relegated ourselves to being just happy to be in the audience and sort of looking up to the pop stars. Mm. So for a long time, we didn't think we could actually be those pop stars.
And actually, the sort of the beginnings of karaoke in the United States go back to a chance meeting, as you write in your book, on the Queen Elizabeth II in 1980. What's that story?
Well, there was a Japanese businessman on the boat who was playing cards, and the guy next to him happened to be an American entrepreneur who worked for the Hal Roach Studio Company, which is the production company of Little Rascals. And they sort of helped each other win this card game, and as the night went on, they started talking about their individual businesses, and the American guy sort of heard about these karaoke machines and thought maybe it'd be worth, you know, maybe trying to get them in America, and just sort of as a lark, as sort of a side business. So that's, you know, apparently, you know, there's this strange connection between the Little Rascals and karaoke in that some of the very first machines were brought over with some of the, you know, the Little Rascals' money. And it took a long time. I mean, they had a lot of problems getting them in bars and getting people to buy them. They were very expensive. they didn't have a lot of songs. It was very hard to imagine them doing well in those days. But everyone sort of stuck with it. I mean, it's amazing to me that despite sort of the early resistance, the people who really believed in karaoke early on, they kept with it for years and years and went through multiple nights of, you know, standing on stage awkwardly and no one wanting to come up and sing with them.
I want to play a cut of music from a band that is near and dear to your heart, the Backstreet Boys, singing I Want It That Way. It's from the 1999 album Millennium. Tell me why. What a piece of music, Brian. But according to your thesis, this song actually is very significant in the history of karaoke in the United States. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I Want It That Way was sort of the penultimate song of the teen pop era, or the teen pop boom of the late 90s. I mean, I defy anyone who's hearing it now in the background to not be singing it in a few minutes from now. It's insanely catchy. Even now, I mean, I've heard it hundreds of times, and now it's kind of, I almost want to sing it again. But, you know, in the late 90s, the teen pop boom really sort of helped push karaoke finally sort of over the edge in America. The entire music charts for, you know, years and years were just full of these incredibly catchy 2.5-minute songs that were made to be sung along with your friends, that were aimed directly at teenagers. And at the same time, the karaoke industry was really starting to push these very cheap at-home karaoke machines. So it was this kind of perfect mix of the right songs that people wanted to sing and having the technology and not having to be 21 years old to go out and sing it. And I think if you look now at the connection between late 90s teen pop and American Idol a few years later, I would imagine that a lot of the kids who were trying out for that first season of American Idol were at home in the late 90s and early aughts singing, like, you know, Backstreet Boys.
And nearly 23 million Americans watched that finale of the first season of American Idol in 2002. Here's a clip of Kelly Clarkson singing a moment like this to screaming fans after being announced as the show's winner. You write that karaoke sort of enabled people, ordinary people around the country, across the country, to sort of pretend as if they were on American Idol.
Yeah, I mean, I think American Idol kind of gave us all this great permission slip to not be afraid to get up and sing. I mean, you know, for years, like I said earlier, you know, Westerners had this very big hang-up of this divide between who was talented and who wasn't, and we were the audience. And people who had talent were the ones who were singing. So if we weren't on stage, you know, obviously we shouldn't be singing. Why would we? But American Idol sort of instilled this very egalitarian view of talent. And granted, you know, Kelly Clarkson's much more talented than any of us are. But the fact that she had this sort of compelling, you know, storyline that she was a former Red Bull sales girl and seemed like someone who lived next door to you and was, you know, seemed like a really nice classmate or cousin made it seem very, you know, it seemed logical that, well, maybe we could sing too. Maybe I didn't have to be as good as Kelly Clarkson, but certainly there was no shame in trying.
Mm. And the third seminal moment, as you say, in the history of karaoke, or rather the rise and fall and rise again of karaoke in the United States, happened in 2003 with the film Lost in Translation. Bill Murray, of course, plays Bob Harris, kind of a washed-up celebrity, hawking Suntory whiskey in Tokyo. He, in a certain scene, serenades Scarlett Johansson's character in a Tokyo karaoke bar.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob Harris.
Thanks. This is hard.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing. Fallen leaves in the night, who can say where they're blowing?
One of Bill Murray's best roles, I think, ever.
Yeah, definitely.
So here you have Sofia Coppola, the director of this film, you know, uber cool director. You've got this very, very cool, slick, crisp film, and you have this karaoke scene. And this, according to your thesis, is another seminal moment.
Well, yeah. I mean, for years, if you looked at how karaoke was treated in films and TV shows in the 90s, you know, something like When Harry Met Sally, where Billy Crystal is, you know, completely embarrassed to be caught by his ex-wife.
At the Sharper scene. Image, right?
At the Sharper Image store, yes, which shows you how dated that movie is now. But, you know, even something like My Best Friend's Wedding, where Cameron Diaz is sort of put on stage to be humiliated. Karaoke was always treated as this embarrassment, and that was the punchline. You know, if you saw a karaoke bar in a movie, you knew someone was going to be made fun of. But Lost in Translation was the sort of turning point in which karaoke was treated as sort of no big deal. And more than that, you know, a karaoke bar became a place where two grown-ups could sort of flirt with one another. And it didn't have an underlying, you know, there wasn't a winking sort of we're making fun of this as we embrace this. It was sort of the most mature, you know, portrayal of karaoke at that point. Granted, you know, it's one of the very few portrayals of karaoke at that point. But I really thought that you could sort of relate to the fact that, you know what, I could go and sing with someone and I'm kind of flirting with them across the room. I could do it in a sincere way at karaoke.
And it's actually, as you say, it's sort of becoming a kind of an earnest endeavor. I mean, people who do karaoke like you and tens of hundreds of thousands of other people, they don't do it in an ironic way.
No, I mean, I find now, especially in the last couple of years, there's really sort of two sort of people who are doing it. There are people who are really, really talented singers and who are clearly using the karaoke bar as sort of an audition or sort of a, you know, practice stage for American Idol or whatever reality show they want to try out for. And I think the other people are sort of like myself and some of my friends, where we see it as a really sort of extreme form of music appreciation. I mean, I'm a terrible singer. I knew when I was a teenager I'd never be in a band, and yet I loved music, and it was always kind of torturous not to be able to perform
right.
It somehow. And
hold,
now we
hold
get to
that
do
thought,
it.
Brian Raftery.
Sure.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're listening to We Built This City by Jefferson Starship, sung by Karen and Dave. I'm Guy Raz in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
We built this city on rock and roll.
This is On Point. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about karaoke and how and why it's exploded. We're joined this hour by Brian Raftery. He's the author of a new book, Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. And Brian, in your book, you write about the little-known industry of producing karaoke tracks. How does a song become karaoke-fied, if that's a word?
That is a word. I like that word a lot, actually. You know, a lot of people sort of assume that when they go to a karaoke bar and they sing along, that someone just at the record label just took the original track and stripped the vocals off. But when I started researching the book, I realized that there is this fantastic company in North Carolina called Sound Choice. And for decades, they had an in-house band that would take every single style of song, whether it was a rap song or a pop song or a dance song, and sort of break it down and then reconstruct it, which I thought was sort of fascinating. It was this sort of science of, you know, it wasn't just, let's just play the notes as they appear. One of the main guys there would go down and track down the original amplifier that, you know, someone used to record a song. And it seems weird to people who haven't done karaoke. I know it's sort of strange to be thinking, well, who cares if it sounds like the original? But, you know, part of the appeal of karaoke is this sort of self-illusion that you are that lead singer for a few minutes. And
right.
The difference between singing with, like, a really great backing track and singing with a really kind of dinky little bad keyboard program track is huge. I mean, it's very hard to feel like, you know, like Mick Jagger when Satisfaction is being sort of played on a little harmonica or something.
Right. But if the tracks are I've always wondered about this. If the tracks are completely redone anyway, you know, why don't they just do away with the sort of long instrumentals, you know, and solos like in Freebird, for example, you know, that are awkward for the singer? Why don't they just cut those out?
I think there's a certain amount of there will always be purists who want to sort of experience the whole song, and those are people who have not realized just how long the guitar solo in Freebird is. I mean, Freebird is kind of the nightmare karaoke song in that it's the song a lot of people think would be funny to get up and sing for the first time and don't realize just how few vocal lines there are. So they kind of have to stand on stage, and I've seen this happen a couple of times with this sort of this Freebird meltdown, where by the third minute of the sort of main guitar solo, they're just sort of panicking on stage.
They're not air guitaring or anything?
You can only air guitar for a minute and a half before you're just, you know, kind of air guitaring wildly and erratically. I mean, there's very little follow-up to air guitar. If you start air drumming or air keyboarding, you're really in trouble. So, Yeah, I would love to have some of those songs without the guitar solos, but I do think that there are certain purists who will want to perform the entire song as Lynyrd Skynyrd did.
Uh-huh. We got a lot of calls waiting on the line here, folks who want to talk to you. David is on the line from Braintree, Vermont. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Guy. You know, ever since I was a little kid in Hopedale, Massachusetts, I wanted to be a singer. And when karaoke first came out, I went to several bars, but I could never get the courage to do it. I sat there and just wanted to, but couldn't. Finally, this Christmas, I bought myself one of those at-home karaoke machines, and now every Wednesday night I go to a local bar and I do it, and I love it. I'm totally hooked.
Brian, it takes courage to do this. I mean, David says for years he wanted to do it. He couldn't do it. Finally, he mustered up the courage to do it.
Yeah, I think that's everyone sort of has that story, myself included. I never wanted to do karaoke for years. I was very resistant to even trying it. And I think you need two things. You need some really good friends, and you need a very sort of continuous stream of alcohol. I mean, you know, that there is sort of the joke that everyone who goes to karaoke is drunk in some ways. And you know, I can do karaoke stone cold sober and still enjoy it. But in that first year, it certainly helps if you have, you know, a little bit of alcohol in you to sort of just to finally give you that little final push on stage. But it's, you know, it's intimidating. It's very strange to get up in front of a bunch of people you don't know and do something that you know you might not be good at. It takes a lot of courage.
Well, what does a typical night out, you know, sort of singing karaoke look like? What are the different types of venues?
Well, we have a very sort of different style of doing it here in America than they do in Japan. In Japan, they have something called K-boxes, which are these really tiny private rooms where you get a small group of friends. They keep bringing drinks to the door, and you can kind of just sing as many songs as you'd like at an hourly rate. In America, we have much more of the sort of show style where you're getting up in front of a small stage in front of people.
Usually at a bar.
Now there are a lot of dedicated karaoke bars, but most people who are singing karaoke out at night are going to the bar, you know, as the last caller said, that has the once a week karaoke night. And you will never get a more diverse crowd at a bar, no matter where you live, than on karaoke night. I mean, it's young people, it's old people, kind of every race you can imagine. It's one of the few times you can go somewhere and just be completely assured that you're going to be surprised by everything that happens.
Rini is on the line with us from Worcester, Massachusetts. Rini, welcome to the show.
Hi, Guy. I just wanted to call in because I absolutely live and breathe karaoke at this point. I started probably about 8 years ago when the movie Duets with Huey Lewis and Gwyneth Paltrow came out. That was my entree. And my uncle was already doing it at a bar in San Francisco called the Yet Law. And I said, if he can do it, I can do it. And went on out. Hello?
Yeah, we're still with you.
This week I debuted as a KJ. And have had great success this week with people praising my job that I'm doing, running the show.
A KJ, well, a karaoke jockey, like a disc jockey, right?
That's correct.
And Rini, what's your favorite, what are some of your favorite songs to sing?
Well, I started with, the first song I ever sang, bad choice on my part, We Got the Beat by Go-Go's. It was way too high for me, and I quickly figured out songs like Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road or Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me Were Better for Me, because I'm an alto and there aren't so many girl songs out there for us altos, so we got to sing the guy songs.
Mm-hmm. Rini, thanks so much for calling. Brian Raftery, song choice is important, you write. I mean, there are certain songs you just won't perform.
No, I mean, there are certain songs, you know, as we spoke about earlier with Freebird, where if it's over 2.5, 3.5 minutes, I really start to think, okay, what does this song consist of? How many guitar solos are there? How long will I be awkwardly standing on stage and not knowing what to do next? You know, one thing I found is that there are certain artists that you can always sort of go to in a clutch if you're really sort of nervous about getting up there. And I've always found that either weirdly, no matter what country I'm in, Phil Collins songs or Hall & Oates songs always seem to be a very good introductory karaoke number. I don't know whether it's the range. I don't know whether it's just 80s nostalgia. But I've never seen, you know, anyone revolt over an old Genesis tune or, you know, Private Eyes by Hall & Oates.
Larry is on the line with us from Venice, Florida. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. I'd like to offer my opinion. I don't think karaoke conquered the world. I think karaoke inherited the world, just like the mammals inherited the world after the asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. And in my case, the dinosaurs would have been live bands, four and five and six-piece bands that played everywhere. I was one of them. I was a nightclub musician in the 70s and the 80s. That was the height of my career. And then the asteroid that came and wiped us out was the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, who I renamed, my pet name for them is the Mothers Against Live Music, because their political agitating brought along such things as DUI roadblocks.
But Larry, what did karaoke have any impact on what you were able to do?
Well, there was no karaoke when I was playing music. And then once the bar owners were thrown against the wall because their customers were being arrested as soon as they left the parking lot, then they couldn't afford these expensive five-piece bands anymore. I used to play five and six nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the bar owners were feeling the pinch. And then along came karaoke, and out the door went these expensive bands, and now we can let the drunks sing to each other.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Brian Raftery, karaoke may have, sort of put some of these live musicians out of work. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, absolutely. I've heard that concern a lot, and actually in the early days of karaoke, there were certain countries that didn't want them at all. The sort of local musicians formed unions and tried to keep karaoke machines out of bars. And it's a very valid point. I mean, karaoke, having a KJ is much cheaper than having a live band. And I've actually heard from a lot of musicians who are frustrated in the way that karaoke has taken over. But it's hard to tell whether it's really sort of destroyed live music. I mean, you know, it's sort of the music industry's argument against downloading. If people are getting up to sing one night at karaoke, they're sort of experiencing music and kind of connecting with music. And so it makes sense that they might just start going out more often and catching more bands and finding more songs they love. So it's kind of hard to conclusively tell if karaoke has driven the live band circuit out of business just because, you know, it's doing so badly anyway. But it's a valid concern. I can understand why people might be sort of resentful that their career of performing in bars has been replaced by these, you know, giant Laserdisc machines.
Now, you actually, Brian, went to Japan as part of your research for this book to meet the inventor of the karaoke machine. His name, if I'm pronouncing it right, is Daisuke Inoue.
It's Daisuke Inoue, yeah.
Daisuke Inoue, okay. He must be a multimillionaire.
You know, he's not. He's a wonderfully sweet guy. He's in his late 60s, and in the early 70s, he was a sort of failed drummer in Japan, and he realized that if he could get into the business somehow of getting people if he was in the music business, he would make a lot more money. So he created this sort of little tiny box and had an 8-track machine and had a microphone, and he would bring it to all these bars and get people to sing. And he never thought to patent it, which is amazing. And he actually makes all of his money now with this sort of strange, giant cockroach-killing machine that he invented for karaoke bars that apparently in Japan they have so many problems with cockroaches in the karaoke bars in Japan, they eat the wires. So he's not a multimillionaire, though he seems very content with the knowledge that, you know, he created something that so many people love.
So, I mean, he created it, but what, he didn't properly patent it, or it was simply just copied, and he was never able to earn the profit from it?
Well, his idea, the way he saw it, was that he basically took a couple of pre-existing technologies. You know, he took an 8-track machine, he took a coin slot from a vending machine, and he took a bass speaker and just sort of threw them all together. So he thought, well, I didn't really invent anything new, which, you know, is noble and possibly accurate. However, you know, very short-sighted when it came to the long history of karaoke's had ever since. He did patent these weird little sort of laminated books that carried the lyrics, but I don't think he got enough money off that to sort of live off.
All right. Dave is with us from Lake Placid, New York. You're on the line. Dave, welcome.
Hey, Guy. Thanks. I think karaoke, well, I'm a professional musician up here. I'm playing out tonight and tomorrow night. We got lots of snow. It's a tourist village. And I think karaoke gives people a chance to shine without all the work, because it took me 30 years to memorize and get my act down, and I'm a guitar player and singer. The only thing I wonder is it a true art form? I mean, you're reading the words that usually take me at least a week to memorize, and the music. I just kind of wonder about that.
That's a good question, and it's something that certainly inspires a lot of passion. Karaoke inspires a lot more passion than you probably ever knew, Brian, or maybe not. is this a true art form, Brian Raftery?
I think you can argue that it is. One of the things I've always been fascinated with popular culture is how a piece of music or a film is sort of interpreted by the consumers and sort of reinterpreted. And one of the things I love about karaoke is seeing someone who truly loves a song take that piece of music for a few minutes and completely reshape it. I mean, I've heard certain karaoke songs dozens of times. I never really need to hear Free Bird again or Stairway to Heaven or My Heart Will Go On. But I've had a lot of great nights at karaoke bars where someone comes up and takes, you know, Islands in the Stream and sort of turns it into a sort of new wave, you know, post-punk sort of number. Or I've seen people take, you know, really hard rock songs and make them very moving and change the context. And I think when you see people connecting with a song that they've loved for so long and sort of finally being able to voice the song the way that they've always heard it, I do think there's an art form to it. I mean, you know, it's a strange art form, and it can be a little jarring sometimes, but I do love hearing people and watching people reinterpret a song they've loved their entire life in an entirely new way.
Hmm. Now, as you mentioned, Mr. Inoue, the inventor of the karaoke machine, he might be called the patron saint of karaoke. Don Henley of the Eagles, strangely enough, is one of karaoke's biggest enemies, sort of the foil to Mr. Inoue. What's that all about?
It's very strange. When I was researching the book and talking to a lot of karaoke industry veterans, his name kept coming up, and even without me prompting it. Not to get into the very sort of boring copyright back and forth, but basically you have to have the songwriter's permission, obviously, to re-record these songs and put them out as karaoke. The Eagles have always been, for, you know, very stringent about what songs they will license to movies or soundtracks, which is understandable. However, somehow Don Henley, because he will not license a lot of his Eagles songs, has become this big sort of punching bag for the karaoke industry, because what happens is they're not allowed legally to put Eagles songs out. Hmm. But as any of your listeners who have been to a karaoke bar probably know, the Eagles are one of the most popular karaoke bands of all time. So basically there's an entire sort of bootleg industry of karaoke, people smuggling in or now I guess downloading illegally recorded Eagles songs. So the karaoke industry always sort of uses Don Henley as sort of holds him up as the guy who's depriving them of income in some way. And it doesn't help that Don Henley has a slightly, some would say, jerky demeanor in some of his interviews. So he's definitely kind of become public enemy number one in the karaoke industry.
Mark is on the line with us from Fort Myers, Florida. Mark?
Hi, Guy. This is Mark in Fort Myers. I wanted to share a story that I witnessed in about the mid-'80s when I was living on the Big Island. I was leaving a hotel after I was a photographer leaving a hotel, and I wanted to stop by this small bar for a quick drink before I went home. And at that time, the Japanese economy was going pretty strong, so we had about 50 Japanese golfers in this bar, and they were heavily drinking scotch, and every one of them saying, "I left my heart in San Francisco." It was just one of the most bizarre and fun moments I have ever had in a bar. And I just sat there as an observer. So it was absolutely bizarre.
Mark
Thompson.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Mark. Brian, you probably hear a lot of these kinds of stories of sort of these memories of karaoke, good and bad.
Yeah, and it's strange, actually. One of my very first encounter with karaoke happened in Hawaii when I was very young, and my father, who is not a singer, I mean, I think I inherited my love of music yet lack of chops from him, went out one night apparently to a Japanese-Korean karaoke bar and wound up singing New York, New York. And, you know, when he came back, I was very fascinated by this. And I think a lot of people have their sort of first-time encounter as an observer. I think most people sort of go and scope it out one night. And I think one of the things that really sort of steers the sort of karaoke naysayers away from just making fun of it is seeing people so passionately sing a song that they really love. And granted, it can be annoying. I mean, I'm not sure how many versions of I Left My Heart in San Francisco any of us would really be able to endure
right.
for more than just 20 minutes or so if we were not already in a bar setting. But it really is sort of a fun way to observe human nature and
right.
to see the sort of role music plays in these people's lives and how expressive they are when they finally get to sing it.
Right. Behind us, we're hearing the song All Jacked Up by Gretchen Wilson. It's being performed by Jessica Murillo at Razzie's Bar in Somerville, Massachusetts. Stick with us, Brian, and you out there listening. We're discussing the past, present, and future of karaoke. Give us a call, 800-423-TALK. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, my God, it's too loud. I can't find my keys in my truck now. So grab time. too, and I broke my window, hurt my elbow, got me in an old two full of air, backed into a life hole. All the townsfolk had a good show, I'm all jacked up.
All jacked up.
All jacked up.
All jacked up.
I don't believe I've ever had this much.
This is On Point. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about karaoke and its mass appeal. We're joined this hour by Brian Raftery. He's the author of Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. And here's some advice for karaoke first-timers from Karen and David. They are seasoned performers at Razzie's Bar in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Pick a song that you're comfortable with that you genuinely like.
If you actually know the words to it, that really helps.
It helps a lot, as it turns out. They are in front of you, but, you know, definitely for your first time, you probably want to do something that you've done before.
Brian Raftery, I have to say I'm intrigued and a bit inspired, and maybe at the end of the hour, the two of us can try a little something together. But what advice would you give to somebody who says, all right, maybe I'll give this a go?
Well, actually, what they mention is the first and most obvious rule, which is that you really should know the song. And that sounds obvious, but you'll be surprised how many people will spend, an hour or so flipping through the book, finally pick a song, finally get the courage to go up there. But what happens is when they're looking at the song title, they're really only running through the first couple of verses in their head. And granted, the lyrics are up there on a screen for you, but you kind of have to know the cadence. You kind of have to know the time changes. And I've seen people sort of go up on stage and realize halfway through that they have no idea what's going to happen next. And it becomes very, very sort of awkward to watch because, they don't know whether to make a joke. They don't know whether to walk off stage. So it is very important to really, truly know that song. Another sort of rule that I always say is make sure you go with a big group of friends. I think it helps to have your friends in the front row. I mean, it helps to look out and see people who are going to sing along with you and encourage you. And that does help a lot with the performance. It helps sort of get you all the way through.
How do you go about picking a song? I mean, what do you sort of consider?
Well,
because you have some favorites.
I have some favorites. I mean, I have some standbys. One of them is Sister Christian by Night Ranger, which has always, for a couple of reasons. I mean, to me, it's always been the perfect karaoke song. Mm-hmm. The first part is that it's a really easy song to sing. And I don't mean that as an insult to the singer. I'm just saying that it's in my range. It has a lot of vocal lines. It pulls out a little bit so you don't get overwhelmed. And it comes in with this great chorus, which everyone who knows the song has probably heard. But, you go, you're motoring. And no one who knows that song and hears it will be able to resist singing along. It's a great sing-along song. And the final reason is that just for sheer nostalgia, I've been doing karaoke for 10 years now in New York, and my friends and I always wound up inevitably closing with that song. So it sort of feels like it's our one constant song that always sort of brings us back to our bizarre karaoke roots.
And you actually interviewed the person who wrote the song.
Yeah, I did, and I think he was only slightly aware of its karaoke following because I do hear it a lot. And I think he was telling me that, as it turns out, that's one of their biggest songs in Japan. And when they recently recorded a live album in Japan a couple years ago, they had actually, when they listened to the audio tracks, everyone in the Japanese audience was singing along. I mean, they may as well have just turned their own microphones down. It's a perfect sing-along song.
This is the band Night Ranger, of course, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chris is on the line with us from Columbia, South Carolina. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, how are you?
Hi.
Point I wanted to make is how karaoke can really be used to give a great gift to someone. Recently, our company had an office party for Christmas. I knew that they were going to have karaoke there for about 2 months beforehand, and I got to thinking, and my wife loves this one song. It's off of the HBO series True Blood called Bad Things, and she loves that song. So I practiced it, and I practiced it for weeks. She was working nights, actually, and gave me a chance to do it alone. And the look on her face in the middle of that party when I started to sing that song to her was just irreplaceable. It really was, and it's something that I think she'll never, ever forget. And that I was able to do that for her was, really good, and that's something that karaoke can do for us.
Chris, thanks so much for the call. And Brian, I don't know if it was half serious or not, but in your book you say that you actually struggled at times with depression years ago, and mm-hmm. karaoke actually had an impact. You even talked about it raising your serotonin levels.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all sort of gone through a period where we sort of turned to the arts in some way to lift us up, and for me, just listening to music when I was sort of down wasn't enough, and I think there was something about being able to go out with friends and to sort of sing these classic breakup songs, these sort of classic down and out songs. And something about seeing the words on the screen while you're singing them was very comforting to me. I think it sort of made me realize that I wasn't, you know, alone, obviously, in whatever problems I was having. And karaoke does lift a lot of people up. And as that caller said, I mean, a lot of people, it's a way of expressing something to your girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife. I mean, a lot of people do sort of communicate through karaoke. And I've had nights where I've seen someone singing on stage or in a room and notice that they're kind of looking at one person and realizing, oh, well, this is their song. This is what they sing to one another. And it's really wonderful to see.
Mm-hmm. Rick is on the line with us from Montague, Massachusetts. Rick?
Hi, Guy. Hi, Brian. I just want to say that one of the best places I know to watch karaoke is at the Crown and Anchor in Provincetown. And it's hosted throughout the summer by people in drag. And it's just amazing to see 1,000 lesbians and gay men singing songs that have a different meaning sometimes.
It's Provincetown, Massachusetts, of course.
Yes, it is.
Brian, karaoke, is it something that sort of caught on earlier with the gay and lesbian community?
I think that was an aspect of it. One of the most famous karaoke bars in America is the Mint Lounge in San Francisco, which has always had a gay and lesbian clientele. I do think that the fact that they would be promoting certain nights out at bars and they became, you know, special nights to sing karaoke would sort of bring a gay and lesbian clientele. I'm not entirely sure how far back that goes or how widespread. The strange thing is we have a bar in Brooklyn called Hope and Anchor, which is also hosted by a drag queen. So I'm not sure whether the word anchor is some sort of karaoke code among the gay and lesbian community. Maybe someone can help me. But, I mean, there's certain, you know, you will certainly go out and there is a certain, you know, it's for a lot of people, I think it replaces both gay and straight. I think it's replaced going out and dancing that you did in your 20s and 30s. This is what you do now for nightlife. It's become a very valid nightlife activity for a lot of people in a lot of different groups.
Now, we should mention that when you go out to do karaoke, there's often a video screen playing some kind of a video. The words are on the bottom of the screen with the bouncy ball sort of bouncing on the word that you ought to sing at that given any given point. The videos are tailor-made for each video. For each song, what's the story behind the production of these videos? Some of them, I mean, just awful, really awful videos.
Yeah, they're very strange and very surreal. And what happened was in the late 80s and early 90s when a company called Pioneer, which was a big Laserdisc company, was really trying to push karaoke into the market, people started making very elaborate and pretty expensive videos. They get about $3,000 or $4,000 a pop. And they would hire all these commercial directors around places like L.A. and New York and Texas and say, look, here's a song. Go shoot basically whatever you want. And so what you would get were these very sort of strange, esoteric, and sometimes very campy, but also sometimes really sort of cool interpretations of what a song was about. I mean, they would take a song that, you know, that you would never imagine to be about, you know, a jet pilot and put a jet pilot as part of the plot. You know, there's a video for Dreamweaver, which is sort of a Top Gun rip off with this woman sort of fantasizes about going into space, which is never what I thought Dreamweaver was about. And they, you know, this there was a whole cottage industry, and it sort of tapered off in the mid to late 90s, and they really don't make the sort of classic conventional karaoke videos anymore. But I'm hoping, you know, possibly the stimulus bill will have some sort of karaoke video provision to get that going again. And
you never know.
A lot of karaoke directors back in work. Yeah, we could use it.
Lena is on the line with us from Canton, Massachusetts. Lena, welcome.
I just wanted to expand on Brian's interpretation of why perhaps Americans were reluctant to sing karaoke and why it took a while for it to grow. And I think there's a big difference in the education in Japan is that all children sing, all children learn to do art, all children learn to do sports. And it's expected that that continues into adulthood. And adults do sing at festivals, they sing at company outings. And whereas in America, if you weren't in the chorus, beyond that, maybe you're embarrassed to sing. People don't feel as though they're confident or comfortable singing. Whereas in Japan, you've continued and you were taught how to sing. And I think that's a big reason why it's more comfortable in Japan. And here, I agree, American Idol sort of given us the freedom to maybe try. But I think our educational system falls short and doesn't teach us the way it teaches it in other cultures.
Mm-hmm. And Lena, we should say you get major props for your pronunciation.
Thank you very much. I did
yes.
live in Japan. So
major props.
I try to spread the word.
Brian, sort of on that point, would games, you know, for PlayStation and Nintendos and so on, like Guitar Hero and Rock Band, Would they ever have become popular, do you think, without karaoke to sort of lead the way?
You know, it's hard to tell if they – I mean, they're such great games that I think they certainly would have caught on. But I think it would have taken much longer for them if karaoke had not sort of laid the groundwork in America. The fact that now, you know, teenage boys who are normally so sort of reticent to, you know, show off in front of their peers and kind of, take in a public skill like that or a public sort of display of affection, as it were, toward music, the fact that they'll hang out on a Friday night and now just sort of sing to one another at Rock Band is amazing to me as someone who grew up and would never sing in front of my friends, even for a video game. So I think karaoke has certainly helped. I think they're sort of very natural extensions of what karaoke does, which is allow you to take a piece of music and sort of become a part of it. And that's the expectation now for young people, is that when they hear a song they love, they sort of expect to be able to interact with it in some way, whether it's karaoke or, you know, MySpace karaoke online or Guitar Hero or Rock Band.
Now, as we sort of spoke at the beginning here, I mentioned that you know, I'm intrigued, but I got to be honest with you. I haven't done it before, and I'm a bit nervous about the idea of you know, singing in front of people listening to this show. What do you normally do for people, you know, who are a bit nervous if they want to sort of, you know, do you sort of go up with them and help them out?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, my first karaoke experience was not only with just one friend, but like half a dozen friends. That's how nervous I was. The best way to start, a friend of mine recently described to me, and I don't have much experience with this, but he basically said it's sort of like doing acid for the first time, which is, you know, you get around friends, you're in a comfortable place, you know that they're going to be taking care of you for the next hour or 12 hours or whatnot. And I think there, as much of a joke that is, I really do think you kind of have to make sure you're in a very comfortable environment. And you really can't care about how you sound, because if you go in a big karaoke bar, half the people who are watching you are waiting for their turn to sing. Yeah. They're just as nervous. To be honest, they're probably not even listening to you. So you don't have to, you know, it's not as scary as so long as you're sort of with some friends and aware that this is, you know, it's going to only take 3.5 minutes. It'll be over quick, and you'll get a big buzz afterward.
Do you know the lyrics to ABBA's Dancing Queen by any chance?
I do. It's a song that's, as someone who is a terrible singer, it is so far out of my range. But it
a
is
bad
a,
choice.
No, it's a great choice because it is a classic karaoke song.
But
it really is.
Why don't we give it a try?
Okay.
But I'm going to ask you to help me out here.
Okay.
So if you will, a little Dancing Queen.
You can dance, you can jive, having the time of your life. See that girl, watch that scene, dig in the Dancing Queen.
Very nice.
I feel so much better. My serotonin levels are way up. Way up. That was very special. Thank you for joining me on that.
Oh, sir, certainly. Thank you for joining me. I mean, I hope you masked my I missed many, many notes in that song, even just only in the first few verses.
There may have been a bit of a satellite delay, but I think that's okay. I think it worked out. We'll
no,
have
I think
to go back
right,
and
yes.
listen to it. But I think that was probably one of the best versions of Dancing Queen ever.
I'm sure. And,
probably
and there have been
better
many,
than,
many.
Than ABBA's version.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, sort of before we let you go, I mean, how do you kind of see the future of karaoke? I mean, you know, where does it go? Are we just seeing a spike now, or is this now, are we now living in a karaoke world here in the United States?
I think we're absolutely living in a karaoke world. I think what's interesting is the sort of shape it's going to take in the next couple of years. I mentioned earlier about MySpace karaoke, and online karaoke has really taken off, where people use a webcam and record their own version sitting in front of a computer, and people rank it up or down. That's not my favorite way of doing karaoke, but I do think you're going to find it becoming a lot more private, at home, using video games, using you know, sort of very small groups. I know some of the karaoke bars in New York are starting to think about making more private room karaoke, just because people just want to sing with 5 or 6 friends, because in an hour you get to sing many more songs and you kind of have a little more control over the room. So I think it's going to become a little more private, but I think it's here to stay. I can't imagine all of a sudden people are going to wake up and think, eh, I don't want to sing anymore. I'm sort of sick of music. So we've got a young generation now that has music in their lives in a way that none of us have ever had before. So I think they're going to grow up truly wanting to express themselves through song.
Any cutting-edge developments on the horizon we should know about?
I think the video games are now that you can sort of download tracks for stuff like Rock Band and Guitar Hero, I think you're going to start seeing a lot more sort of digital delivery of karaoke. That's always sort of been the predicted future, that you can do it from home, and rather than only having a couple of you know, discs that you use, you just sort of wind up dialing in and getting the songs, you know, straight to your brain, which is, I think, is pretty exciting. So
Brian Raftery is the author of Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Brian, thank you so much for actually helping me get through my nerves on karaoke. And you know, I think I'm going to go out to a karaoke bar right after the show, actually.
You should do it. We should go out for a night and do this town up with a couple more ABBA songs.
Thanks. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Just need someone to love.